Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Jimmy Miller. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me. Super excited for our chat.
Thanks for being here. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah, so, I was recently laid off at Shopify. So at Shopify, I was working on YJIT, the Ruby JIT compiler that Shopify is building. Had a great team there, really loved the work I was doing, but, you know, things happen. Now looking for a job. In my spare time, though, I'm also co-host of the Future of Coding podcast. Been doing a little streaming, you know, having some good time with my time off
nice.
On top of job searching. So,
yeah. And when I saw that the layoffs happened, I put out a call on Twitter that said, like, hey, if anybody got laid off by Shopify, I'd love to have you on the podcast because helps me, helps you kind of thing. But I think I actually just found you and I thought you seemed like an interesting person. And so I invited you on the show.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the tweet that you made after you had already invited me. And I was like, oh, I didn't know how related those things were or not. But yeah, I think it's awesome that you're bringing on people to, you know, help them out, right? There's a lot of great people laid off at Shopify. You know, it doesn't seem like it was, you know, I think that sometimes I maybe had the kind of negative perception of like, if you got laid off, you might not have. And like, that's just not true, right? Like, people are getting laid off who are wonderful people, great contributors, and it just happens, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's hard because like, You probably, like, it's hard to shake that stigma because it's like, maybe you got laid off because you sucked, or maybe you got laid off just because they had to cut 10% and like they had to cut good people and bad people. But like an external person doesn't know that. And so you have to, if you're like, no, I'm actually good.
Yeah, it feels weird, right? Because like, of course, you know, you also kind of like internalize it. Like, I will happily admit I was not the most talented individual on my team, right? Like, I worked with great people who have way more experience in Ruby, in compilers. You know, Maxime, the lead on the team, I mean, she invented the technique that we were using for YJIT. Like, there's no question if I had to make the choice, I would not be, you know, the top person on the team. But at the same time, I know I'm a good developer, and you know, you have to like kind of tell yourself that, right? Like,
yeah, right. So I think we might know some of the same people. You said Maxime.
Uh-huh.
I think if it's the same person, I met her at, what was it, RubyConf 2021 in Denver.
Yeah, and you've had Ufuk, who was my manager.
I was going to ask that too.
A few times, yeah. Ufuk's a great manager. It's really nice of him. He did a quote tweet when I put out a tweet saying I got laid off, and Ufuk gave a really nice message, quote tweeting my tweet. So yeah, I worked with just great people there. It's, you know, now though I'm looking for my next opportunity. Luckily, I got very fortunate that the tweet I put out about being laid off kind of went, at least for me, viral, like 200K views or something like that. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've had like 16 interviews in the last 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
I maybe booked them a little too much. Some of them were just not good fits, but you know, there's some things out there, but I really want to take the time and look for the right opportunity, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, you can't throttle it to your exact preference. Like you can control how many places you apply to, but then you can't really control how much comes back.
Exactly. The speed at which everything goes. And, you know, it's stressful, right? Like I've never been in a position where I've been laid off. Well, I worked at a small consultancy once, and on Wednesday they told me that paycheck on Friday, yeah, we're not going to give you that. You still work for us. So we're just not going to, we just don't have money.
Which, oh,
like,
no.
I understand, you know, like they were great people, but like that's not quite the situation I signed up for. So I found a short-term contract and, you know, was able to take a longer time on the job hunt, but.
I see. The closest thing I've had to that was like, it was maybe a Friday and somebody called me either from my client or from the recruiter that connected me to the client. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, everything's fine, but like Dave said to take the next few days of the next week off. But everything's okay. We'll talk on Wednesday or something. I'm like, interesting. That's usually what happens when everything's fine. They just call you on a Friday and tell you not to come back to work on Monday.
Yeah.
Shockingly, not everything was fine, and the whole thing ended.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes your income unexpectedly goes away, but that's life.
Yeah, my wife's last job ended because the owner got arrested as the FBI was raiding the place for money laundering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a horse barn. My wife's a horse trainer. And so it was a pretty complicated thing because there are like 20 horses there. Like, where do they go? The whole thing was a mess.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, a good friend of mine ran an illegal poker ring for a while, and he got raided and was like handcuffed for like hours in his apartment.
Wow.
Yeah.
When I was 16, the Secret Service busted in my door for quote unquote hacking.
Wow. What did you do?
It's definitely my most, like, you know, when they're like, tell your most interesting story about yourself or an interesting fact. That's always the one I get to tell. So first off, the Secret Service does more than just president stuff. So everyone's really confused when I say Secret Service instead of like FBI or something. But apparently they deal with internet fraud stuff as well.
I had no idea.
So yeah, at 16, I worked for a major grocery store, a major regional grocery store. In the Midwest here, and I just pushed carts. Like I didn't do anything, you know, important. But I was programming, and I really hated checking my schedule. I wrote a program to check my schedule for me. Well, as I was doing that, I was like, okay, you know, I'm gonna send the request and see which error I get back when I don't send my credentials, so I can figure out how to send them. Well, I just got my schedule, and I didn't get any error. It's like that's weird. So I like visited the URL directly. I was like, oh yeah, I'm not logged in. I went back a page. There's my social security number just like plastered on the page. All you needed was an ID and you got everyone's bank account information, social security numbers. Yeah, everything. So I tried to report it. And my brother, who was older than me, told me, like, you shouldn't give this information away for free. You need to ask them to pay you for the vulnerability. So I followed my older brother's advice. And now it's considered, like, blackmail.
Oh, wow.
So first off, like, you know, advice to people, don't report vulnerabilities unless you, like, go through a company that has a proper policy for doing these things or whatever. Obviously at 16, I had no idea. Long story short, they did not contact me back and instead contacted the Secret Service, who then busted in my door with a battering ram at 6 a.m., put me in handcuffs. I told the agent, I'll say his name, Agent Monsma. That's the only person I remember of this whole thing. I told the Agent Monsma the whole story of what just happened. And I kid you not, he just kind of looked away for a second, looked back at me and goes, well, I think someone overreacted here. But you're facing 30 years pending charges at two states and at the federal level. We'll investigate. But I don't think anything's going to happen, and no charges were ever filed. I got all my computers back. They took all my computers.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a search warrant. It was wild. Yeah, needless to say, not a fun circumstance as a 16-year-old.
Yeah. Around now, you'd be like still in prison or close to getting out?
Oh, I mean, if I actually got 30 years, I would be halfway through.
Oh, so. Wow.
Yeah. Obviously, I would not have. I did not do anything, you know. It was a pretty clear thing of just like stupid kid goes and finds a vulnerability and doesn't know how to report it. In general, though, if you report a vulnerability, you have committed a crime just by finding the vulnerability.
Yeah.
Because you have gained unauthorized access. That's why you have to have a company that has a policy for these sorts of things. It's very muddy waters. So definitely, I end up like even later trying to report vulnerabilities to people, and it's just not a good idea. Don't do it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made me think of a funny story that I'm not going to tell on the air. Anyway, so yeah, that was kind of, had you been, so obviously at age 16, you had a level of sophistication enough to go and do that thing that you did. When did you get started coding? What age?
Yeah, it was either like 11 or 12 was when I first started programming. I kind of had like these like dual starts. Like first, my brother, my older brother again, Fred, he was really into like Photoshop and really wanted to get into animation. And so he started trying to learn Flash, and somebody had given him a book on how to do Flash. And it was mostly about the coding aspect, not about the animation. He didn't realize that. And he looked at it and said, this is impossible. Nobody could ever learn this. So I took that as a challenge, and I went and learned just a tiny bit of Flash. But then he decided that I wasn't allowed to use the computer anymore. It was his computer. And he gave me a computer from the trash that he had found. But that was my computer. And I had a friend in elementary school who had told me about Linux because his dad was a sysadmin. And I didn't understand anything he was talking about, but I remembered the word and I ended up Googling it. After like 50 burned CDs, I finally found Ubuntu and got it running on this computer. I got a wireless card because there was no way I could stretch cable to where the computer was located. I got a wireless card, made this Windows wireless driver work for it. I was resolving the dependency tree by burning CDs because that was the only way I could transfer data.
Oh, wow.
And like manually compiling in Indis wrapper was this thing that let you do Windows drivers on Linux. Anyways, got it working and I was just hooked. Like it felt so magical that I had gone from this computers with Windows ME that I couldn't use to a computer that was my own. And so I really wanted to learn programming and just kind of dove in headfirst from there.
Yeah, that's so great. I was a Windows user from age like, I don't know. I started when I was like pretty young. It's hard to say. I kind of say that I got started programming when I was like 12 in like 96, because that's when I made my first web page.
Yeah.
But I like kind of like gradually, it wasn't like I got a computer when I was 12 and like that was when I hit the ground running. Like I had been messing with computers like ever since I can remember being alive, because we had computers around. But then I didn't discover Linux until I was like 21. So there was a good like 9 years that I was a Windows user. So I got kind of I came around to it slowly.
Yeah.
But when I found it, I never went back.
Yeah. See, I'm a Mac user. We had a Mac at the time, and you know, I used Linux for years, but I just found I spend all of my time just tinkering with my Linux install. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is like there's fun to that. But I ended up, you know, having a Mac that I liked and I didn't tinker with it constantly. But it was also mostly just like circumstance. You know, someone gave me a Mac that was much faster than my desktop, you know, at the time. So like, why not use it?
Yeah. And I should clarify by saying I never went back. I mean, I never went back to Windows.
Gotcha.
I'm not a Linux user today. I'm not that masochistic. I use it for all my Well, I guess I use Unix locally because that's what Macs are built on. But yeah, all the hosting is Linux. I would imagine the idea of having a Windows server in the cloud, like that's just comical to me.
Yeah, that's just wild. My first job was in a Windows shop, and it was strange.
Yeah, but I'm glad I went through it because it's like now I know how good I have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk a little bit about YJIT. Last time I had Ufuk on, we talked about some of that stuff, but it's been long enough ago that I don't remember, even though it's only been like a few weeks. But what is YJIT?
So YJIT is a JIT compiler for Ruby. It shipped with Ruby 3.1, I think, originally, and is in Ruby 3.2, and of course will be in 3.3. All it does is take Ruby bytecode and compile it to machine code on the fly. So it makes all of your code run faster.
Okay. It compiles it on the fly, so it makes your code run faster. So it compiles it on the fly as opposed to parsing it in real time?
As opposed to ahead of time, right? So if you're thinking like your standard like C, C++, right? Like you have a compile step that you actually have to do. So you write your code, you run compile, you get out a binary at the end. A JIT compiler, a just-in-time compiler, is deciding which bits of code it should compile and then sometimes recompiling that or making decisions at runtime on your behalf rather than a separate step ahead of time. So for example, there's a threshold. Only if your method is called in times does that method now get compiled to machine code. And then we also might not compile the whole method. We get to a branch and we just stop at that branch and put some stubs out there so that once we go back and we figure out which path we're going down, we're going to compile that path. There's like little tricks that you can do to not make big, huge code size when you have a dynamic language, but also still get some real good performance.
I see. It sounds like it's kind of a question of what's the most economical way to compile or not compile pieces of code for maximum performance.
Yeah, and the thing that's really complicated about JIT compilers and performance in general is just there's lots of different things you could be measuring when you say performance, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at benchmarks, So if you look at like benchmarks of YJIT versus like Truffle Ruby at peak performance absolutely runs away with performance. Like it's so much faster than what YJIT can do on certain benchmarks, right? On really micro benchmarks, Truffle Ruby is so smart that it can basically turn the benchmark into nothing, right? But oftentimes what you actually have to care about is like what the details of those benchmarks and how you're getting those numbers. So Truffle Ruby has what's called a warm-up time, every JIT compiler does, where it's like when do you get to peak performance? And Truffle Ruby gets peak performance, but it takes it longer to get there. Whereas YJIT, we don't get as fast, but it gets there faster. It happens sooner.
I see. Is that kind of maybe analogous to when you use caching in an application and you start off with a cold cache? It takes a while for the cache to get primed because everything starts off cold. And then after the application has been used for a period of time, then it's much faster than it was when everything was cold. Same idea?
Yeah, definitely very similar there. I think, with the cache, the only difference is you can sometimes... So if you look at, like, for example, JavaScript and how, like, V8 runs, right? They have this series of tiered compilers. So they'll start off and your code will run a little bit slower, and then they switch you over to the faster JIT compiler. And then in the background, they're doing all this optimization to make your code even faster, and then they swap you over. And so there's like different levels of speeding up your code that happen over time. And those are doing kind of like background processes and all sorts of complicated stuff. And YJIT really focuses on this like being a very good what's called a baseline JIT compiler, where there's not tons of like complicated optimizations, and instead is just focused on getting that code out there fast to the hardware so the hardware can start running straight machine code right away.
I see. Something that's really interesting to me about performance is how it's like, it's not just one thing, it's like these bazillion little techniques. At least that's the way that I look at it. Like if I look at it, okay, so from the very outermost, highest level of it, one of my like principles that I follow is if it seems fast, it is fast. And so like the thing that matters isn't whether it's fast. The thing that matters is whether it seems fast. And a lot of times that's the same thing, but it's not the same thing enough of the time that it's worth it to think about it in those terms, I think. And so I think the very first thing with performance is to like consider, can we frame this UI in a different way, for example, to make it seem faster without having to incur the expense of doing all the work to actually make it faster?
Yeah, no, I think when you're talking about from a user's perspective, right, there's a lot of different things that you can be interested in. I think the other side of this, though, is not just from the user's perspective, but from the infrastructure perspective, right? So a lot of why you might care about something like a JIT compiler is not end user time. It's how much of your CPU usage, how many servers do you need, right? Like how much infrastructure are you having to make to be able to serve users at the level you want to be able to serve them?
Yeah, there's like two kinds of performance. There's like how fast does this perform on my local machine? And then there's like what kind of load can we handle?
Yeah, absolutely. And the less, as requests take longer, even if for the user you've done some magical tricks to make it feel like they're not, if there's actually something in the background, you know, doing 400 milliseconds of work on the CPU, and you can reduce that down to 300 milliseconds, now you can handle more requests. You might be able to scale down your servers to save you money. There's all sorts of different things that happen from this. This is why, like, you know, I'm kind of an outsider in the Ruby community. Like, I haven't really done any Ruby before joining Shopify and working on YJIT. But like, I saw just how beneficial this YJIT project is because it really focused on a really smart way of doing this JIT compilation where it remains compatible with all the rest of your Ruby code. There's nothing you've got to change. And it just makes the code you're writing today faster for free, right?
Yeah, that's great. And I want to be clear, I think a lot of people already understand this, but maybe a lot of newer people have less of a firm grasp on it, which is the kind of stuff that matters at Shopify scale. It doesn't come into the picture for most applications most of the time. Like usually for most applications, people are building at like a small business where there's like a team of two developers, like your bottleneck's going to be your database queries and stuff like that. It's a long time before you get to the point where the back-end language is the bottleneck.
Yeah, I to be clear, I'm definitely not saying go shift all your stuff to Rust because that's the only way your application's going to be fast, right? Like I'm a big fan of like dynamically typed high level languages, even if I have to trade off that performance to get it. But if we can have the best of both worlds, why wouldn't we want it? And you're right. Like a lot of times your bottleneck is, you know, that database layer. But I think you'll be surprised that when you start actually going and profiling your code, you'll be surprised how much is in that CPU layer.
Interesting.
Right. I don't think I could ever share like Shopify's numbers because I don't think those things are public or whatever. But in past applications that I've worked at, when I really focused on performance, I was able to get either twice as fast or 10 times faster in some cases, just on the CPU performance. And these were on languages that were, you know, like Ruby, you know, that are not trying to be the most high performance ever. I was able to just modify that code a bit and get way more performance that had nothing to do with that that IO, right?
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's like news to me and eye-opening. So next time I'm doing that kind of work, I'll pay more attention to that area of it. I just had to give that like obligatory... It's like anytime I'm talking about performance on this show, I have to mention like premature optimization, stuff like
Absolutely.
That. Because there's always like that one guy where like there's a Stack Overflow answer and he comments like, this is like not very performant though. And it's like, well, how maybe this page is visited once a month. And if it, you know, it's like it doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, no, if you premature optimization is definitely not what you should be doing. Like if you really want to understand your performance, profile your code, see where you're really spending the time. Maybe it's IO and you can, you know, batch up some fetches because you're doing a bunch of back and forth. Maybe that query that you're doing, you like we also often think about our database as like, oh, well, the database is IO, right? It's input output and it's spending all its time doing reading from disk and, you know, all the things that databases have to do. But if you start looking into those SQL query plans, it's often not the case. It often is spending most of its time doing some very weird CPU usage stuff because it has a bad cached query plan. Or like I've had to dive into all of those sorts of things. And I was able to actually at a company before, it was an ad tech company, and I was in charge of their whole reporting infrastructure. And we had a lot of reports that would take 30 minutes, an hour, 6 hours. And we had no visibility into like what was happening and why all these reports were taking so long. And so the first thing I did as I joined the company was just get a nice dashboard that showed every report, how long it was taking, which companies it will, you know, were doing what, et cetera. And I started looking at the slowest ones. And I noticed that every single query was looping over doing a sequential scan on this whole entire table. Every query I looked at. So I made like a thing that would randomly pull up queries and look at the query plan. And I couldn't find a single one that wasn't. And I looked at it and there was just this one little line in SQL that if I changed it, I made every single query twice as fast as what it was before.
Wow.
And so it was one of those things where, like, you know, sometimes we stop at that, and sometimes it's good too. Sometimes we stop at the abstraction boundary of that's my database. It just has to take time. But if we just take that peek in a little deeper, we can usually find something that we can get performance gains out of.
Yeah. Sometimes I think about when you put a lot of time into something that ultimately becomes just like a one-line change. It's mm-hmm. kind of funny to consider like this one line change cost like $5,000.
Exactly.
And then the payback for this one line change was like $100,000.
Yeah.
And that's kind of funny because it's just like such a small change, but so much money went in and comes out.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting the way that programming kind of I think it changes the way we think about things. It changes the way we see the world in a way that a lot of people who aren't programmers just don't get. Like you kind of see behind the scenes of everything going on, right? Mm. You can kind of speculate about like I'll help, you know, my friends who have like a weird error on some web page and I'll have to go into the console and fix it for them so they can submit their form for the government or whatever because mm-hmm. the website's just broken, right? Like I don't know. I think that the more you're willing to peel back those layers and see what you've kind of considered like the black box, the more fun it is, in all honesty, but also the more enlightening it is. And so that's what's really fun about building a JIT compiler is I never thought, you know, I don't have a degree. I don't have any formal training whatsoever in programming. I kind of came up by the web teaching me about how programming works. I never thought I'd be able to do this kind of low-level stuff. I thought it was just beyond my ability. And so it's really fun to dive into that stuff.
My background's the exact same. No degree, just self-taught, all that stuff. Yeah. So I think you mentioned that before Shopify, mm-hmm. gotta be careful not to say Spotify because I've done that sometimes.
Everyone does that. It's fine.
Right. What did you do before Shopify if it wasn't Ruby stuff?
Yeah, so a lot of what I was doing before Shopify was working in Clojure. So closure, for anyone who doesn't know, is a not super popular language. It is a language on the JVM, so the Java Virtual Machine, and it is a Lisp. So it's a dynamically typed functional Lisp, which is quite a bit away from kind of the mainstream world. But I just like programming languages. So I also, in my spare time, was doing a lot of Rust, which is why I took the job for YJet. Super excited about Rust. But I also just, I think the more programming languages we have, the better, to be quite honest with you.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in that. But first, before I forget, I feel like it's not too much of a long shot for me to ask. Do you happen to know Eric Normand?
I don't know him personally. I know of him. He's also in the Future of Coding Slack in our community. So, and I do listen to his podcast, but I have not met him personally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to check. I met him some years ago. We talk every great once in a while. So you said you think the more programming languages, the better. Why do you say that?
Yeah, I think that programming languages are, people often look at them as just tools, right? Like, they're the things that let us build our businesses. They're the things that make us make programs so we can make money. I don't really see programming that way. I got into it not knowing that this was like a job you could do. Like, I had no idea people got paid to program. And when I finally like heard like, oh yeah, people get paid to program, I assumed it was very different from the programming I was doing. I thought like they must be doing something real way more complicated, and because this is just fun. And so like, I think of programming languages as a way to express ourselves, a way to feel a certain way, to explore ideas. And I feel like there's just a lot of ideas left out there to explore, a lot of different ways of programming that we haven't really looked at. And I think, you know, Ruby to me, even though I never did much of it, like, I think it was such an interesting exploration kind of in that small talk history. It was really looking at, it's a language from its time. I'm not saying like of its time as in like it's a legacy bad language, but you can see the time that it was created, the principles, the ideas of its creators, like all of that. And I just think that's beautiful. I think languages kind of bring together a community, cause people to think differently. And I just think we need more of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And I don't disagree with any of it. And I like to think sometimes about like, in the distant future, what are things going to look like? I, first of all, I'm sure that the way we program will be something we can't nearly conceive of today. And people will look back and be like, wow, I can't believe that we had like a framework where you'd program HTML and CSS and Ruby and SQL. And like, maybe there's something that's like more unified and abstracted and something like that in the future, or maybe not. I don't know, because some things are like irreducible. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to think about that sometimes, like, just because the way we do things now is the way we do them, like a lot of these things are like accidents of history and stuff like that. They're not the way they are because it's the most optimal way to be. And so I try to like occasionally bring myself out of that and say, hang on, if I were thinking totally from scratch, would I interact with the computer in this way or in a different way? I don't have any specific thoughts based on that, but that's how I think sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I've mentioned the future of coding a couple times, and I only recently joined in like the last year on the podcast, and it's gone through a few different hosts. And so, you know, I can't speak for all of the backlog, but I think this most recent thing, what we're doing is we're diving into some like old computer science papers, some new, but a lot of them from like the 60s, from the 80s. And they were people imagining what computers could be like. And so it's really interesting to see how much of that happened, how much, you know, they were imagining what really came to be. But it's also really interesting to see how different their conceptions of computers were, what they imagined the future would be like that didn't happen, and what have we missed from some of those, right? I think that's, if you actually look on our Slack, I think the absolute longest thread we've ever had was about renaming the future of coding, because as I think my co-host Ivan put it, he doesn't like any word in the title, in that name, except for of, maybe. The future of coding, right? So like, he doesn't like the, there is no one future, right? Like, we're trying to explore many of them. Future, like, are we really only interested in the future, or like what could be, and what, you know, what is now and what's the past? And coding, like, he's a big visual programming kind of person. So, you know, typing in code is not really what he wants programming to be like, right?
Interesting. Yeah, just rename the podcast to Of.
Yeah. It was. We went through a bunch of naming suggestions. Of, I don't think made the short list, but we decided it. Like, nothing like stuck out as like the better name or whatever. And you know, it has some recognition. Like, we have some meetups in New York and London, which is really exciting. I sadly don't get to attend those, but you know, really cool to see people exploring these areas.
Where are you located anyway?
I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Oh, okay.
So, what about you?
Michigan, just outside of Grand Rapids.
Okay, cool. Not far.
Yeah, fellow Midwesterners.
Yes.
Yeah, and when you said that Midwestern grocery store, I don't want to say the name because, you know, you didn't want to say the name, but
yeah.
After the show, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to make my guess as to what it is. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I've been, so you mentioned about like reading old computer science papers and stuff like that. I lately have felt like a thirst for programming literature that I feel has been not quite satisfied yet. One of the more recent programming books that I really enjoyed was Code Complete by Steve McConnell. And Steve McConnell is somebody whose writing I really enjoy. I feel like he treats things with like the level of nuance that they call for. And he's not afraid to, like, I don't know, a lot of programming literature that I have a distaste for is the kind of thing where people express the opinion that, like, there's no right way to do it. Whatever works for you is good. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of true. And like, I'm on board with that sentiment in certain ways, but also like, some things are really just better than others.
Yeah.
And we should like admit that. And what I like about Steve McConnell is he's not afraid to like say, this is good, this is less good for these reasons, and just is very refreshing.
Yeah, it's really hard. I've been trying to figure out how to draw this line. I think like earlier on, you know, I've gone through different phases in my career and in my thought on programming. Like earlier on, I was a little bit more strong, like, this is the right way, and maybe a little bit too much of a zealot about it, right? Like, this is the only right way, and if you're doing anything else, you're wrong. And like, I want to have a sort of pluralism. Like, there's lots of different right ways, but I also don't want the like anything goes, right?
Yeah, I think there's a distinction, which is not that nuanced, but people should make this distinction more, is there's a difference between there's no single right way and there's no wrong way, because those are two very different things.
Yes, and I've seen many, many wrong ways. My first job was just an absolute like trial by fire in working with crazy code. There was one guy who did not work at the company anymore, and I know his name. I never met him. And maybe I don't know. I actually am interested in meeting this guy, because like, while I'll say his code is crazy, he also was impressive in the volume of his code. So Brian Onichilla, if you happen to listen to this, I'm down. I really want to meet you. Anyways, so he wrote the absolute, I mean, tens of thousands of lines of code in a weekend. You could see like, yeah, I'm not even exaggerating. He didn't use source control. So he hated source control, apparently. These are all rumors, you know, the myth of Brian Onichilla. but his hard drive from his desktop was raided on a coworker's desk, because they would continue to find source code, like programs he had made for some random person in the company. And like, they didn't know where they were. And like, they would still be like, they'd be like, hey, I really need to change to this application. They're like, what? Oh, Brian made it for me. And they would go try to find it. But like, one bit of application he had, it was like 17 layers nested deep of inheritance. But all the methods in all these classes were empty.
Okay.
Which is like, you're like, huh? Like, why even have this? Because he used reflection he would build up instances of these classes and then use reflection on the methods and on which things it inherited from to build a pipe delimited string that he would send over a socket.
Wow.
So like trying to find this bit of code in the mess of all of this class craziness going on was just absolutely wild. I tracked down one bug in his code for, it turned out not to be a bug in his code, but a bug that had interactions with a bunch of his code for a whole year. And it was very satisfying when it only appeared every 2 months or so. It was very satisfying once I found it.
That's always so satisfying to spend a lot of time and effort on something and then you finally get it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great feeling. Yeah, so there have been a number of people I've encountered in my career who have like way more cognitive horsepower than I do, but they don't have discretion. And so they have like this, they have this like extreme cognitive ability, but then they do these crazy things with it. And it's like, wow, you're really, really smart, but in like kind of a narrow way. And so that it's no good to only be smart in that very narrow way. You need to be like smart in several different kinds of ways in order for the whole thing to like add up to a good result.
Yeah, I found a lot of people that I've worked with that you could describe the way you just did of like very, very bright, but then like it's hard to work with their code, right? Would be like the more concrete way of putting it. Like they write a bunch of code that's really clever, really smart, accomplishes a bunch of things, but anyone else who works with it doesn't want to, right? And I think a lot of it is that these people don't see code as functioning as a communication medium.
Right, because code has two jobs. One is to meet its functional requirements, and the other is to be changeable. And they're probably thinking mostly about the functional requirements part and not about the changeability part.
Yeah, or they might make it super changeable, but only if you know the key secret to how to change things, right? Like if you ask them to go change their code, they're usually very fast going and changing it, right? They know exactly where to change it, what to do. But our code communicates not only in like our variable names and, you know, in the comments and things like that, but even implicitly in its structure. Like think about the code. If you've worked on a code base with like, you know, an old code base with lots of different people who've worked on it, or a code base where there's different teams all working on the same code base. There's some bit of code in there that nobody wants to touch, right?
Right.
And maybe it's because that this person over there owns that code, and if I touch it, they're going to get mad at me, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's because like it's so esoteric and old, and like if you change anything, it's going to break other parts of the system. Well, just the fact of that code existing, if you go look at all the code around it, it's communicating that problem. You'll duplicate code that shouldn't have been duplicated because you don't want to go mess with that thing. You'll write all these functions. And so if you start looking at like the structure of the code, you can learn about like the social aspects of the situation the code's in.
Interesting. It's like that piece of difficult to understand code makes a crater around it or a splash around it. It has ripple effects, which makes total sense. I wanted to come back to something you said a second ago. The clever code thing. I've heard so many times people, the advice like, don't write clever code because it's clever, but like, it's not very easily understandable. I would love to see like 100 concrete examples of what people mean when they say that. Because I actually haven't encountered a lot of that. What I have encountered is like really obscure code. Like there was a time many years ago, somebody like replaced a piece of my code with their code, or like I had to change their code. For some reason, I had to work with a piece of their code. And there was like this algorithm that sorted these records, and the variable names were like A, B, X, all that kind of stuff. And it was impossible to understand. And I wonder if people are making the distinction between cleverness and just plain obfuscation. So I would love to see examples of what people are talking about, because I have a hunch that a lot of the times they're not just meaning cleverness, they're meaning obfuscation.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I think the cleverness retort is often used as like, I don't like your code. Mm. Right. So I had somebody tell me that I was being clever earlier in my career. I was writing clever code because I used map instead of a for loop.
Yeah.
Right. And that's,
I don't feel like that was a valid criticism.
Yeah. For somebody who's never seen map and filter before, though, it might feel a little too clever. And you can even imagine the Stack Overflow person you talked about saying it's not as performant, right? Like, it, which it's not. Like, if I could have made the code more performant in JavaScript with the for loop. But I also think, I don't know, there are bits of code that's very clever, like Duff's device that I don't know what it does, but I remember it, and I know it's a clever little thing in C hacking world. There's things like I really love giving people the programming challenge, not in an interview, just to be clear, of write FizzBuzz, but don't use if statements, Booleans, or pattern matching.
Interesting.
It's a fascinating little problem, and you have to be very clever in your use of different language features to make it work. I've seen like 10 different solutions, and they're all what I would call clever.
Interesting.
I think clever code, yeah. If your goal is, hey, I'm writing code that needs to be maintained on a team for a business that is making money and other people are going to have to change it, writing clever code's probably your obscure code or code that other people aren't going to understand is not a good idea. But also, writing a quine and the way you made the quine work, which is a program that outputs itself, mm-hmm. is clever code. And that's pretty darn cool to me.
Well, man, it's so interesting how like so many of these seemingly cut and dry concepts and words are, because like the word clever, like that actually, now that we're like examining this, like what does it mean for code to be clever? And I'm coming to realize that I think code can be clever in quite a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think clever, a piece of code can be clever in a way that is perfectly appropriate, because if it's clever and idiomatic, then mm-hmm. that's a much different thing than if it's clever and very strange and like shoehorns a piece of functionality that was intended to be used in a certain way, and it uses it for this completely different purpose that you would never expect. Like that would be like misleading. And so mm-hmm. that's not as good. But like if it, for example, uses some like obscure native Ruby method that most people haven't heard of, where mm-hmm. like your example of like a for loop versus map, like yeah. that's a fairly clear instance to me where it's like, that's not, how do I put it? Like you could come across a piece of clever code and it would prompt you to learn something new about that language. Mm-hmm. And that's appropriate because it's like you should know the language that you're working in. And it's not bad to stumble upon something and have to look up a new method or something like that that you didn't know before. So I think yeah. that kind of cleverness is fine.
Yeah. You know, I think all of these things, cleverness is definitely going to be person relative, right? What I find clever, you might not. And so it also is going to be language relative. Like, you know, there's certain things that I could do. I think like Go is a great example of a language that really tried to just ban cleverness, right? Mm. It stripped, especially Go 1.0. There's no generics. It's just if statements and checking if errors happen very explicitly, no exceptions. Like, and the Go creators were very explicit about it. They're at Google. They have these people graduating who don't understand the complicated code that, you know, more senior people were writing, and they wanted a language where you just couldn't do that. Mm. Whereas like Idris is a language that most people probably haven't heard of. It's a dependently typed language. And what that means doesn't matter here, but it's like static types on steroids. Mm. And one thing you can do is you can make make printf where you have like a formatted string. You can at compile time, right, you can write a function that at compile time checks that string is correct. And it's very clever the way this works. looking up Idris printf. It just kind of like, it's this bit of clever code that makes you understand dependent types in a way that I never did before I read that example.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never heard of Idris or dependent types. So that'll be something for me to go research later. I want to bring up something else you mentioned a while ago, and this goes back to a Steve McConnell thing, actually. The scenario where you don't want to touch a piece of code because somebody else wrote it and maybe they're territorial about it.
Yeah.
Steve McConnell advocates for collective ownership of code, where like when you commit it and merge it in or whatever, it's now owned by the team, not one individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that. And I've adopted that view myself. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that because when I read that, I read that in Code Complete. When I read that, that was like one of those nuggets that like you read a book and you find these nuggets occasionally. It's like, yes, I'm going to keep that and remember that. That was one of those things.
Yeah, I will say I've been on the bad side of that.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I was at this company and we had four teams all working on the same code base. Four teams of about like 6 to 8 people. And our product owner really strongly believed in collective code ownership. They were not an engineer themselves, but had somehow in some agile training or something grasped onto this. So they very intentionally would make a card that touched one area of the code base, assign it to team A, and then next time a card came up with that same area of the code base, assign it to team D. And then continuously, intentionally swap these things around.
Yeah, that doesn't seem, I'll just say candidly, that doesn't seem very smart.
Uh-huh. And as you can imagine, we would try to advocate for like your people who are more familiar with that code are going to do better. But they said, if you want to really take seriously the idea of collective code ownership, you got to spread it around so that people become more familiar with it. And it caused that code base to be a real pain to work on. And it imagine. Made it really not fun to take those cards.
Yeah. You know, I think there's something to be said about like stress testing that concept where it's like, how do you really know if this code is going to be understandable to anybody else unless you actually make somebody else work on it? I understand that. But it's like the pendulum swung too far, I feel like.
Exactly, right? I think with all of these things, I do think that these principles are interesting, and I do think there's something good about you shouldn't be precious about your code, right? You shouldn't be somebody who gets mad when other people change your code. But oftentimes, if you look at open source projects, and there's been studies like looking at, you know, how many people contribute, if you look at code bases, oftentimes someone just becomes really knowledgeable of one area. And as long as they're not territorial about it, it can often just be beneficial for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a matter of trade-offs. Like if you have at one end of the spectrum, everybody has like total ownership over a certain area and only they touch it, you get certain benefits from that. But there's certain costs to that too. And then the other way around where you're like intentionally making people move around wildly, there's benefits to that, but it also has a cost. And there's some balance of that that's probably the right answer. So, in talking with you for this last hour or so, I can tell, well, I like your opinions about things and you have a very, I respect your opinions is what I'm saying. And so I'm very interested to hear your take on a topic that really stirs me up.
Okay.
And I feel like it's very, I see a lot of confused and poor advice and stuff like that. And I've talked about this on the show a lot before, and that's the topic of duplication. And this is one of the things where we talked about things being more complex than they seem. I started to write a blog post on this topic, and then I realized like, well, hang on, maybe I don't even know what I think about this. And this thing I thought was one thing is actually four things. And then there's two things inside of this one thing. And it ended up being very complicated. So this is a very broad question, but like, what's your take on the topic of duplication?
Yeah. I think with all of these things, which, you know, is always the boring answer, but like, I think you have to look at like what your goals, what your context is, what you're trying to accomplish, right? So duplication can be bad. It can also be good. I do think if I have to like try to summarize it and not give caveats, I err on the side of Dan Abramoff has a blog post, write a wet code base, write everything twice, where he's saying like you should copy and paste things until you know that you shouldn't. It's more or less the way he's putting it, like have at least two or three instances before you go try to deduplicate something. But I don't know if I actually think this is the right topic. Like duplication or not duplication is the right way of framing the problem.
Well, so the first thing I think people get wrong is even what duplication is. Mm-hmm. And that's something that took me years to put my finger on. Like, I didn't even realize until maybe a year ago. It's like, whoa, I didn't even know what duplication is. And I realized, well, somebody else had to tell me because I didn't figure it out on my own. Duplication is when you have two or more copies of the same behavior, which may or may not be two copies of the same code. Mm-hmm. And you can have you can have duplication without actually identical code. And then you can have two pieces of identical code without having duplication, because those two things, even though they're incidentally identical, they really truly are two separate things. And if one changes, it does not logically follow that the other should change too. That's not duplication, even if the code happens to be identical. And I also went from thinking about duplication as being bad or not bad to rather it has a cost. And sometimes it's a cost worth paying and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, I think that those are both, you know, things I would generally agree with. I think, though, I actually think people often, when they talk about duplication, they're thinking inside one code base, I have a function or a method that does the same thing, right? And should I go abstract that out and make an abstraction or combine them or make a dependency? But I think oftentimes the advice we give at that level is going to be very different from the advice I'd give at a system level. So some people think that you can take that code base and like maybe you should like deduplicate that function. Let's just say we have a case where you should deduplicate that function, put it somewhere else and reuse it, right? It's the right answer. When we're talking about systems and we have like a service over here that has functionality A and a service over here that has the same functionality, it's almost never the case that you want to deduplicate.
That makes sense to me, because is that another? So I've not worked in like systems that are architected that way, but I imagine maybe the reason, well, maybe you tell me the reason.
Yeah. So one thing that is different here is dependency is complicated as opposed to being easy inside of a code base. So what do? We make a third service that you now each of these services call into. Well, now you've added latency between these services. Oh, well, then we don't want to add a third service. Maybe we make a shared library. But now that shared library is versioned and we have to make sure everyone's on the same version. So now you've coupled like when do you deploy in order to make the functionality, right? Like when we think about duplication, really, I think the better thing to be thinking about is dependence, which is exactly what your talk about they're not really duplicated is about. One doesn't depend on the other. They can change separately. And so often we frame it as duplication when really we're asking about dependencies. And
well, go ahead. I was just going to say that with the two services example, what that made me think about is how today, not just with duplication, but with a lot of things, I don't think of them as being good or bad, but rather having costs and benefits. And with the duplication between two services, it's like you don't get an option that's free. You have to pay a cost somewhere. And you can either pay the cost of having those things be duplicated, or you can pay the costs of unifying them, but maybe the unification is more costly than the duplication. And you don't like either, but you don't get the option of doing something that's cost-free.
Yeah, and I'll just throw one other thing out there that like I've been trying to make a habit of, like, when I think about code, you know, I started not knowing it was a job, and a lot of my code opinions have become like about what's the right thing to do at your job. That's not the only place I code. That's not the only reason people code, right? Like, maybe you're making generative art and you want to copy and paste your function because you don't want to make a dependency relationship. Like, you feel like it. You like it, right? It makes you happy to go rewrite that function again. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I think we so downplay the individual programmer's motivations, mood, desires. And I don't think we can, because, like, even if you follow all the best practices, you have the perfect linter set up, you do everything right, but all your programmers are miserable, your system's not going to be good to begin with, right? And I think we got to also just say, like, you know what? Maybe I am going against what best practices is, but I feel like it. And, like, don't do that at the expense of others, but, like, sometimes that's okay.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people focus too much on efficiency on the scale of minutes and hours, and not efficiency on the scale of months and years. I think people should... I think it would be a good thing if more of the time programmers gave themselves permission to be wasteful. Because... Yeah. I think by being wasteful and allowing yourself to follow your whims and desires and do things that are exploratory and not directly connected to something that's clearly productive, that actually makes you more efficient on the scale of a year. Because the question is not what output can you achieve in a day? The question is what output can you achieve in a year, I think.
Yeah, and I think... we get so hyper-focused on, like, doing the job that we don't realize, like, our learning is part of the job. And even things that are not seemingly directly applicable. Like, I convinced a company to let me go to Strange Loop, a great conference, having their last year this year. And I had to convince them because they didn't think it was relevant to the job. But we had a production outage that, had I not gone to a talk at Strange Loop, I would not have been able to fix.
Yeah, interesting.
And, like, that was not my motivation for going. It's not the talk that I liked the most, but these things end up finding a way to be useful for us. I know more about compilers than any job would have taught me, and I ended up getting a job working on a JIT compiler because, like, I spent the time to go learn those things, even on the clock. Or not on the clock,
yeah.
We're mostly salaried, but, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the idea of a liberal education. I've read in this Carl Sagan book once that he studied physics at the University of Chicago. And he said at the University of Chicago, it was unimaginable for a physicist not to be educated in the Greek classics and certain other things that I don't remember. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think there's value in, I think kind of the definition of a liberal education, if I'm not mistaken, is like, you're just learning stuff for no end in mind.
Mm-hmm. To make you a better person.
Yeah, and it's like you can't know in advance what you're going to... Like, it goes again to, like, not worrying about being efficient. Like, if I tried to be efficient and only learn the things I knew I needed to learn, I'd actually be so much less efficient because I'm very not judicious about what I read. Well, I kind of am and kind of am not, but, like, I indulge myself in my whims. And if I see something I want to read, I'll read it even if it has nothing to do with anything. But then, like, sometimes that stuff comes back in very unexpected ways and provides a benefit that I never could have foreseen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm not only, like, don't focus on efficiency. I'm kind of, like, anti-efficiency. Like, the very idea of thinking about efficiency feels like the wrong focus to me. You know, companies can think about that if they want, of course. You know, they've got to think about money and you're employed and you got to make sure that you're helping your company make money, et cetera. But, like, why have we let that be our focus as programmers rather than, at least for me, you know, what I got into this for, which is exploring ideas, being able to express myself, being able to create things, learning, right? Like, those are way more interesting to me than what the most efficient method for doing something is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole nother, That's another like fractal topic where it's like, well, in what context do you want to talk about it? There's your personal life, there's your work life, all that stuff, but maybe for another day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're past the hour mark now. I feel like we could talk for quite a bit longer, and I hope someday you might be up for coming on the show again. But for now,
absolutely.
Yeah. Before you go, is there anywhere you'd like people to go online to check out your what you're up to and all that?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter. I'm also on like Blue Sky and Mastodon or whatever. You know, no one knows what the answer is anymore. Jimmy H. Miller is where I'm at there. But, you know, I'm also doing some streams on Twitch, also Jimmy H. Miller. And then Future of Coding podcast. I mean, that's the real thing I would definitely recommend everyone checking out. We have a good community. We have a fun podcast. It's a little different than we're trying to do something a little different, something a little fun. You know, I think there's a lot of great tech podcasts, and hopefully we can contribute to that, you know, great landscape of podcasts. So just like I think there should be as many programming languages as we can, I think there should be as many podcasts as we can get. So
definitely agreed. And we'll put all that stuff in the show notes. And Jimmy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you.